Good morning, everyone. You are very welcome to our service. Welcome to anyone who is watching on our webcam, and welcome to you if you are listening to us on our recordings page on our website. My name is Gavin Byrne. I'm a ministry student with the Unitarian College. Now, we have a tradition of an open pulpit where members of the congregation are given the opportunity to lead a service or give the address. And today it's Rory Delaney's turn. George Marshall, who wrote Challenge of a Liberal Faith, says, "The theologians gather dust upon the shelves, but the poets are stained with my fingers and blotted with my tears. I never seem so near the truth as when I care not what I think or believe." The following words are inspired by a conversation I had last Sunday after our service. And some of these words are mine, and some are from George Marshall. "We come together not because we think alike, but because we seek together. Ours is a liberal faith, which demands personal responsibility, lifelong learning, and the courage to question and to grow. It is not our way to just accept what we are told is true. It is not an easy path, but it is a deeply meaningful one. A liberal faith such as Unitarianism is not based on fixed creeds or dogmas, but on continuous growth and change. And therefore, we welcome new truths from science, from philosophy, and from personal experience, not just scripture and tradition. We are always learning more about life, and so our faith must grow with our knowledge. We value reason, conscience, and individual freedom in matters of faith. Our liberal faith encourages each person to think for themselves, because the mind was not given us to be muzzled. Or as Saville Hicks once wrote, God's greater Bible contains all that is best and noblest in and highest in human history, in human thought, tradition, and conduct. Every scientific fact and discovery, every heroic life, every splendid aspiration is part of the continuous revelation of God to humanity." This is our anniversary service, celebrating 162 years here in St. Stephen's Green. And we have stories to tell today of the Great Ejection, when ministers and their congregations throughout these islands lost their freedom to worship because of their liberal and open-minded approaches to religion. And so today we assert that love is the doctrine of this church, and let us recite these words together. We don't have our regular hymn book to hand, but I'm sure many of us know them by heart. So let us read. "Love is the doctrine of this church. The quest of truth is its sacrament, and service is its prayer. To dwell together in peace, to seek knowledge in freedom, to serve mankind in fellowship, to the end that all souls shall grow in harmony with the divine, this do we covenant with each other and with God." And we now light our chalice, which is lit everywhere Unitarians gather in prayer, celebration, searching, and love. And today we remember James Douglas, who died at this time 1 year ago. We light our flaming chalice as a beloved people, united in love and thirsting for justice and peace. May it melt away the fetters that uphold injustice and hatred in our midst. May it spark in us a spirit of humility. May it ignite in us radical love that transforms our energy into purposeful action. This is a chalice of audacious hope. This chalice shines a light on our shared past, signaling our intention to listen deeply, reflect wisely, and move boldly toward our highest ideals. Now, all our hymns this morning will be from the old book, and they were carefully chosen by Rory and Josh. And our first hymn is number 289, Who Would True Valor See? Our first reading this morning will be given by Andrew.
Morning, everyone. I'm sure, like the rest of you, to hear that the Indian people in our community have had racial abuse directed at them recently is very distressing, very upsetting, and very shaming. And that's how I felt, deeply ashamed when I heard of what had happened, particularly, as many of you know, I work as a nurse, and a lot of my colleagues at work are from India. And I have to say, every single one of them is such fabulous people, fabulous culture, such really beautiful people. And to hear that they received this from our own fellow country people is so upsetting. So that's what led me to find this poem that I'm going to read today. So this poem is by a guy called John Rodell. And just to tell you a little bit about him, he's a comic who unexpectedly gained nobility as a writer and a poet through his heartfelt Facebook conversations that went viral and became an Amazon best-selling book titled Hey God, Hey John. He's an author of 5 books, and he explores through his poetry the concept of our grief as a natural wonder that terraforms the landscape of our world in increments. Offering us a sincere and very relatable look at his faith crisis, mental health, personal struggles, perception of our world, and even his fashion sense, John's writing has been shared millions of times across social media and lauded by fans and readers worldwide. He teaches at universities and retreat centers across the US, blending his trademark comedy with creative exercises, journaling dialogue, and introspection to help people fearlessly embrace and share their personal stories. So that's a little bit about him. What I really want to share is the poem. So the poem is called An Open Poem to Closed Hearts. When you hate someone else because they are different than you, you are unknowingly hating on the very architect of creation itself. To rage against a color you have never seen before because its exotic tincture offends your orthodox eyes suggests that you believe the divine artist is worried about what you think. Did the first burst of cosmic energy care about its critics when it began to paint life across the constantly unfolding canvas of the unknown universe? Hell no. It just wildly created this delicate masterpiece of endless fire, orchestrated chaos, and a trillion or so wobbling worlds like Michelangelo, made out of an army of swarming angels. Every inch of everything exists is a unique piece of abstract splatter art. So if the divine was so unrestrained when it came to creating the stretching forever kingdom of stars, it would make sense that God was even more uninhibited when it came to how we were made. Each of us are a wow sculpture of unbridled, never-seen-before genius. Who are you to decide how the everlasting potter molds their art? Get over your fear of people who look, live, pray, love, believe differently than you do. Because the more you hide from what is foreign to you, the more you hide from the miracle of this existence. You only get to ride this skin and bone roller coaster for so long. Quit closing your eyes. Stare into the swirl, because that's where God's most profound artwork is. Hurry up. Open your eyes. You're missing it. Open your eyes. Hurry up. And once you do, you will see it. The relentless power of creation. Oh, and how you'll gasp when you finally see it.
I think George Marshall would have loved to have heard that poem. So our story today for our children and our young people is called The Whale Who Wished He Had Wings, She Had Wings. So in the deepest part of the ocean, where sunlight dances gently on the waves and seaweed swims like lullabies, there lived a young whale named Willa. Now, she was small for her age, with a silvery blue back that shimmered like moonlight and eyes full of wonder. Willa loved her ocean home. She played with dolphins, swam through coral tunnels, and listened to the hush of the sea. But every evening when the sun dipped low and painted the sky with gold and purple, Willa would look up. High above the waves, birds soared through the open sky, gliding freely with their wings stretched wide. And Willa would float just beneath the surface and sigh. More than anything, she wished she had wings like the birds. Not to leave the ocean forever, but just once to fly, to feel the clouds, to see the world from above. So one morning, Willa decided to do something about her wish. She swam far and wide until she found her wise old friend, Olive, the octopus. And Willa found her tucked between the roots of a coral cave. And Olive listened quietly as Willa poured out her dream. "You may not have wings," Olive said, her voice calm and kind, "but sometimes dreams find a way, just not the way we expect." With hope bubbling in her chest, Willa decided to get a second opinion from another friend. So Willa reached the rocky shore where a flock of seabirds rested on the cliffs, and she found her friend, Mimi, a great white seagull with feathers like snow. The gull blinked at her kindly. "Willa, you may never grow wings," she said, "but if you trust us, maybe we can help you touch the sky." So the next day the sea was calm. The gulls gathered above as Willa dove deep below, and with all her strength she swam upward, fast and strong. At just the right moment, the gulls swooped in around her, flapping their wings in rhythm as Willa burst from the surface in a spray of silver and light. For one breathtaking second, Willa was in the air, surrounded by birds, kissed by sunlight, the sky open and blue all around her. Then she splashed back down with joy sparkling in her heart. So that night, as she swam beside her mother under a sky full of stars, Willa whispered, "I think I flew today." Her mother smiled. "The sky is beautiful," she said, "but the sea is your home, and you, Willa, are perfect just the way you are. Not every dream needs wings. Some just need wonder, courage, and a little help from friends." Willa never stopped dreaming, but from that day on, she no longer wished to be someone or something else. She was a whale who had touched the sky, and that was more than enough. Now let us sing once more hymn number 90. God speaks to us in bird or octopus or even whale and song. My reading this morning is inspired by Rory's address, The Great Ejection, and he's going to tell us all about that soon. So I thought I would do some research and write for you something of an introduction. Suppose a letter arrived from the government addressed to the Unitarian minister. And the letter begins with a long title, so please bear with me. An Act for the Uniformity of Public Prayers and Administration of Sacraments and Other Rites and Ceremonies, and for establishing the form of making, ordaining, and consecrating bishops, priests, and deacons in the Church. Dear Minister, under the aforementioned act, you are required to do the following. 1. To give a complete and unqualified assent to the newly published Book of Common Prayer of the Church. 2. To subscribe to the 39 Articles of the Church. 3. To renounce the Solemn League and Covenant. 4. To renounce any attempt to alter the government of the Church or state, and 5, to receive ordination at the hands of a bishop of the Church. You must be in compliance with the above by the 24th of August 2025, the Feast of Saint Bartholomew. Yours sincerely, etc., etc. Now, this letter was not only sent to ministers of religion. If you were a student in Trinity College, if you were a schoolmaster, a politician, a military man, you were also required to agree to this. And it was only men who got this letter. So, how did the ministers of 1662 react? We have the words of the Reverend John Whitlock, minister at High Pavement Presbyterian Church in Nottingham. And he spoke these words to his congregation before he lost his pulpit, before he was made an ejected divine. And I quote, "The minister's silence should cause people to speak the more and louder to God in prayer, for the continuance and restoring of ministers and ordinances to them. When you do not hear so much and so often from God in preaching, let God hear the more and oftener from you in prayer. Ply the throne of grace. Give God no rest till he make Jerusalem a praise in the earth. Do not forget us, but lift up a prayer to God for us who have labored among you in the word and doctrine." As you can hear, essentially, he pleaded with his beloved congregation to flood heaven with prayer. But what was so objectionable to the nonconformists, the dissenters? Well, firstly, their objections to the Book of Common Prayer stemmed from their belief that it contained practices and doctrines that were too similar to Catholicism and lacked sufficient biblical grounding. The Protestant Reformation just didn't go far enough. And secondly, the nonconformists believed that written prayers were a human invention that stifled the spirit. and they preferred spontaneous and unprepared prayer, where the minister would pray his own words, not in words given to him in a book. Now, the 39 articles, now what was so objectionable in those? Well, these are just a few things they objected to. Kneeling for communion, the sign of cross in baptism, wearing vestments, the ring in marriage, and they objected to the appointment of godparents at baptism. Essentially, the Book of Common Prayer lacked biblical purity. Now, I think today we might be in trouble with both the establishment and the Puritans of the time. The Unitarian movement was not at this stage on the scene on these islands, but we did emerge from these nonconformists. And we had an even more radical proposition, equally illegal, and which became the most dissenting denomination. And Rory will take up the story in his address. Let us now pray for peace. And this prayer will be followed by a time of silent meditation and will be brought to an end by some music from Josh. We call to mind the peacemakers and neighbors of differing faiths, with different histories, with different politics, with different experiences, who find room for each other in their hearts, in their dreams, and in their lives. Those who hold firmly to a vision of peace and justice anywhere in the world. But especially today, in Ukraine, in Palestine, in Israel, in Sudan, and anywhere there is conflict. Spirit of life and love, be present with all who are suffering terribly from violence and hunger. Lift up the hearts of those who fear and inspire courage among peacemakers. Be present with political leaders, ensuring a retreat from violence and a procession towards the peace table. Guide the hands of all who are caring for the injured, for the hungry, and the grieving. And open our own hearts to compassion. Remind us of our complicity and responsibility. And lead us towards generous engagement. And move us always toward a vision of peace. Amen.
It's great to see you all here, the people up in the gods. Hopefully you'll still be here by the time I'm finished. Today's service, and as mentioned by Gavin, is our anniversary service. That might be causing some head scratching among you because the church opened on the 14th of June. However, the pulpit wasn't available on the two nearest Sundays. So Gavin asked me, could I find an alternative date? So I picked today, the 24th of August. As it happens, it's my late mother's birthday today, and it's also the 10th anniversary of my mother-in-law's death. So if they have the webcam wherever you are, you say hello to Madge and May. The title for the address was to have been St. Bartholomew's Day, but as a concession to Gavin, which I will call him at some stage, I agreed to use the title The Great Ejection. To confuse things a little bit further for you, if the address had been delivered in June when it was intended, the title would have been Bunhill Fields. Hopefully I can bring all three titles together into something coherent enough to be of interest to you. Also, today is the end of Heritage Week, so it'll sort of chimes with that a bit. You're really getting four for the price of one here. Some of you might remember an article I contributed to the Uskilt in 2014 called Bunhill Fields. In the unlikely event that you do, I hope you don't remember it too well, as I'm going to recycle an abridged version of the article as the first part of this address. The article was stimulated by some of the debates then in swing during the lead-up to the 2014 Scottish independence referendum. In the event that Scotland broke away from the United Kingdom, some people were expressing thoughts as to the necessity of a new national anthem for England and what that new anthem might be. My tuppence worth was this. If our neighbours in England should choose to have an English national anthem in place of, or in addition to, the anthem of the United Kingdom, the hymn Jerusalem will, I'm sure, be among the leading contenders for selection as England's national song. The words of the hymn were published in 1808 as a poem by William Blake and set to music by Hubert Parry in 1916. At first glance, the words appear to carry a strong patriotic sentiment, and indeed, the hymn is associated in many people's minds with the type of gatherings at which the assembled believed themselves to be the upholders of England's finest traditions. As we now only use the old hymn book once a month, that was in 2014, Jerusalem is one of the many old favourites which are not sung on Sunday with the frequency that they once were. When it received an outing on the first Sunday of October, it was sung and accompanied with an enthusiasm which may have caused some arch eyebrows among newcomers to the church. Had they just walked in on some old boys' reunion, reaffirming that at least one part of Dublin would remain forever England? In anticipation of questions from our visitors, some regular attendees seemed to be almost mentally preparing some humorous apologies. But the hymn has never been the exclusive property of any old club from any particular section of society. A very wide range of groups have obviously found their own meaning in Blake's words. Jerusalem has been sung over many years at a wide variety of different events and occasions. In addition to royal occasions and Conservative Party gatherings, the hymn has also been sung at Liberal Party conferences, and for a period it had an almost equal billing with the red flag at Labour Party conferences. So I would suggest, while a superficial reading of the words of the hymn would place it firmly in one tradition, a deeper consideration of the hymn's words and a brief reading of any biographical sketch of Blake would place it firmly in a totally different tradition. Born in London in 1757, Blake has been recognised as one of the great poets and painters of the Romantic Age. Although he cooled on his initial support for the American and French revolutions, he remained a strong supporter of the anti-slavery cause, and he maintained a friendly relationship with Thomas Paine. One of his biographers attributed Blake's political outlook to the influence of the dissenting religious tradition, which had its roots among the opponents of the monarchy in the English Civil War. that he is buried in Bunhill Fields should really end any argument as to which political tradition has the greatest claim to Blake's legacy and, as such, to the hymn Jerusalem. The Bunhill Fields is in the Shoreditch area of London and is something of a dissenter's mecca. It's tucked away in this area in the city of London can be found Wesley's Chapel and the Museum of Methodism, the Quaker Cemetery, which is now a garden, and the Bunhill Fields burial ground. The burial ground was in operation from 1665 to 1854 and is the final resting place for many of the well-known radicals and dissenters of that period. When the burial ground was given protected status in 2011, the Guardian newspaper noted that in the 19th century, when it had already become a place of pilgrimage for nonconformists and radical reformers, the poet Robert Southey called it the Campo Santo, the holy ground of the dissenters. Many of the people buried in the cemetery suffered a lifetime of persecution for their beliefs before coming to rest here. The article went on to note that left-wing pilgrims of many shades visit regularly to lay wreaths, including the Blake Society members, who come every August on the anniversary of the death of a man who wrote Songs of Innocence and the poem which became the hymn Jerusalem. After many previous postponements, I finally got to spend a few hours in the cemetery in 2014. Most of the graves and monuments are in railed-off sections of the graveyard and can only be visited by arrangement. But in an open section where pathways converge, there is a simple memorial to William Blake and his wife Catherine. Close by in the same section are memorials to the dissenters and authors Daniel Defoe, best known for Robinson Crusoe, and John Bunyan, author of A Pilgrim's Progress and of Who Would True Valor See, the hymn we opened with today. Nearby, inside one of the rail sections, is the grave of Reverend Isaac Watts, a dissenting minister known as the Father of Hymnody. 8 of his hymns appear in our old book and 4 in the new book, and one of them is our next hymn. The roll of names of those buried in Bunhill Fields amounts to something of a who's who of every shade and includes Protestant dissenters of every shade and includes the names of at least 4 ministers who occupied pulpits here in Dublin. Reverend John Owen, described as an intellectual and physical giant, was the very first minister of this congregation, and his portrait hangs downstairs in our vestry. Reverend Daniel Williams was called to Wood Street in 1667, where he remained as minister for 20 years. He donated a considerable sum to the congregation for the education of young people, the support of a preacher to the native Irish, that means Oscaige, and for the relief of the widows of poor ministers. He is better known, though, for the substantial donation of money and books he made towards the founding of the Dissenters' Library in London. Dr. Williams' Library, as it became known, has had many Unitarian links since its foundation, particularly with the Newington Green Church. The library is alive and well today and describes itself on its website as the preeminent research library of English Protestant nonconformity. Reverend Nathaniel Marr was one of an influential family of New England Puritan ministers. He succeeded his brother here in Dublin at New Row, and he remained as a minister in the city for 17 years before moving to London. And finally, Reverend Thomas Emlyn. Now, more biographical sketches of Thomas Emlyn have appeared in our publications than probably any other person who was ever associated with the Dublin churches. But again, but just very briefly, Emlyn was a minister in Wood Street from 1691, who in 1702 published a pamphlet, A Humble Inquiry into the Scriptural Account of Jesus Christ, which we all know ended up with him being jailed and fined, and he actually became the first minister to be known as a Unitarian minister. Interred as he is in such illustrious company, the question then which the Dublin members should really be asking regarding Blake's Jerusalem is not, why do we sing it? But rather, why don't we sing it more often? Also interred in Bunhill Fields are several members of Oliver Cromwell's family. Mentioning Cromwell's name in the same breath as radical dissenters can trigger varying degrees of emotion and disbelief here in Ireland, and I have noted at times a bit of unease in our own pews. I don't intend to mount a defence of Cromwell here today, but if the requirement arose, I think I could make a decent job of it. If I did put up a defence, though, I wouldn't be the first to do it from this pulpit. In 2010, we published What Do These Unitarians Believe? A collection of sermons by Reverend Saville Hicks, minister here for 52 years. In the foreword to the book, the late Reverend Bill Macmillan of Dunmurry, who had been a ministerial student under Saville Hicks, wrote, "From how many other clerics with students have been advised, dare to go on thinking and never be ashamed to say, in all reverence and honesty, I have changed my mind. I delight in the thought of an Englishman at the beginning of the 20th century telling an Irish audience that Oliver Cromwell had some merit. He daringly recommended Cromwell's advice. I beseech you, in the mercies of Christ, to think that you might be mistaken." From my mid-teens to my mid-20s, I was very involved in social politics and activities in groups that had deep connections with socialists in England. Over the course of many visits and exchanges and to reading books and pamphlets and singing songs, it became clear to me that whatever about Cromwell, there was certainly a very different view among English socialists of the movement that Cromwell was the head of. Contained within that movement were the early Democrats, men and women who wished to see an end to the absolute powers of monarchies in the state and of hierarchies in the churches. The more radical elements, the levellers, the diggers, the ranters, wished to see an end to monarchies and hierarchies altogether. One of my favourite quotes, which I remember picking up on at the time, and it pops up every again now and again in books about socialism in worldwide and in the UK, Colonel Thomas Rainsborough's contribution to the Putney debates. And he was making the argument for democracy. It was a limited democracy at the time, but democracy nonetheless. "For I really think that the poorest he that is in England hath a life to live as the greatest he. And therefore, truly, sir, I think it is clear that every man that is to live under a government ought first, by his own counsel, put himself under that government." Following the victory of the parliamentarians over the monarchy, clergy and administrators who supported Parliament were appointed to civil and church offices across England and here in Ireland. The first bunch of names that appear on our roll of ministers were among the appointees: John Owen, who I've already mentioned, Stephen Charnock, whose portrait is also in the vestry, Edward Baines, Thomas Harrison, who donated the silver that the church owns, and Samuel Winter and Samuel Mader. After Cromwell died in 1658, a period of political uncertainty and instability led to Charles II being offered the throne that was vacated when his father was executed. The restoration of the monarchy in 1660 was followed quickly by the restoration of a church hierarchy. Here in Dublin, a great service was held in St. Patrick's Cathedral on the 27th of January 1661, when 12 new bishops were appointed. An anthem composed for the occasion includes the verse, "Angels, look down and joy to see like that above a monarchy. Angels, look down and joy to see like that above a hierarchy." The Commonwealth had come to an end, and a purge of the republican forms of government from the restored established church commenced. The following year, an act of uniformity was introduced. All church ministers were given until the 24th of August 1662 to conform to the Act. Those who dissented and refused to conform were to be ejected from their positions and livelihoods. The 24th of August was and is St. Bartholomew's Day. Historical significance of the date wasn't lost on the dissenters. Exactly 90 years earlier, on the 24th of August 1572, thousands of Protestants were slaughtered in France. The memory of St. Bartholomew's Day massacre in France was hardwired into Protestant minds, particularly into the minds of those who believed, with very good reason, that the Stuart kings were secretly Catholics who wished to have an all-powerful monarchy like those in Catholic France and Spain. In their sermons and publications, Dissenters were quick to liken the events in France and the Great Ejection, deploying the term Black St. Bartholomew's Day to refer to the ejections. And it was used over and over again in the subsequent years. In 2009, we transferred the library we had downstairs in the vestry across to Trinity College. For some reason, about a dozen books were overlooked and they're still down there in the press. I have two of them here with me. The subject of both books is the Great Ejection. One was published in 1727, maybe an original, and likewise the other one was 1806, also maybe an original. Even if they aren't originals, the books are still older than this church. I just want to, one of them is a collection made by the one published in 1727, Edmund Calamy, and it's a collection of the farewell sermons preached on the 24th of August, 1662, by the ministers who had not conformed. Now, it's a collection from across England. We don't know what the sermons were here, but maybe someday we'll uncover them. In the preface, he said, most of the sermons contained in this collection were delivered on the 24th of August in the year 1662. On that day, the act requiring a perfect conformity to the Book of Common Prayer and to the rites and ceremonies of the church took place. The effect of which enactment was the silencing of nearly 2,500 ministers, the death of 3,000 nonconformists, and the ruin of 60,000 families. Such was the result of the restoration of Charles II of infamous memory. Most of the ministers in Dublin, in fact, I think all of them, of the ministers in Dublin who had supported Parliament during the civil wars, refused to conform to the Act and were ejected from the positions they held in the cathedrals and parish churches. Many of their adherents left with them, and together they set up new congregations of dissenting Protestants in meeting houses at different locations around the city. Our ancestral congregations, Wood Street, New Row and Cook Street, all came into existence shortly after the Great Ejection. Conventional Irish history is inclined to lay things out in lists of goodies and baddies. And top of the goodies, of course, are the United Irishmen. And no doubt top of the baddies, or somewhere near to it, are the Cromwellians. No one ever seems to notice about the religious descendants of the baddies, or Unitarians, or the people who have the greatest claim to be their descendants, are Unitarians and Quakers. Hardly people we should be all fearing. In his book, A Deeper Silence, The Hidden Origins of the United Irishman, Dr. A.T.Q. Stewart traces the tree of the United Irish radicalism back to a previously ignored source. Ministers of Grace is the title of a chapter in the book that is devoted to the lineage of the ministers of the Wood Street congregation, the grandparent to this congregation. It opens. Some special quality attaches to the Dublin ministers, setting them apart from the rest of the Presbyterian body, yet connecting them to obscure dissenting congregations in the English Fenlands, to Rotterdam and Leyden, and to Roxbury and Boston and Massachusetts. What this quality is precisely is not at first easy to identify, since there are several strands to it, and they have been the subject of little or no research. The essential clue does not present itself in conventional summaries, and it is not too difficult to be led on false trails. But once it is found, most of the other parts of the jigsaw fall into place. It is exemplified in the history of the Wood Street congregation. We are proud and fond, and rightly proud, of pointing to our United Irish connections around the building. The Emmet marriage certificate, the baptismal register, and other items around in our records that connect us to Robert Holmes, the Emmet family, Archibald Hamilton Roan, William Drennan, the radicals of the 1798 period. Supposedly, if you accept conventional Irish history, these people are the polar opposites of the Cromwellians. But we should remember, these radicals of 1798 took their seats on Sunday in the Protestant dissenting meeting houses and Strand Street and Eustace Street, both buildings paid for by funds left by a former captain in Cromwell's army. They are likely to have taken communion served on the silver left by a chaplain to the Cromwellian administration in Dublin Castle. And they probably borrowed books like this one and writings of all dissenting ministers from the Meeting House Library. If we join the dots, it's not a huge leap of imagination to suggest that they took a lot of their inspiration and principles from the same sources. We really shouldn't exalt one group and ignore another. When closing off the book, Calamy's book, although we do not expect another Bartholomew's Day or fresh edicts of prescription and banishment, let us remember the days of our forefathers and study their principles. Our city walks are back again in September, and the one on the 7th of September will be around the parts of the city where people were ejected from and where they set up their new meeting houses. All welcome, as usual. Amen.
Thank you, Rory. Let us grab our hymn books once more and turn to number 362, O God, Our Help in Ages Past. And after that, we will have the collection.